Okay, any questions on this? Anything that isn't clear? There was a certain amount of, yes, a certain amount of antipathy, partly because some were indigenous southerners and some were northerners, and because of this geographic, like north-south, Yankee, Dixie, this in every country in the world, this north-south division usually. And it's very different from us, you know. As I say, it's a north-center south, a Nam Tonkin. It's a cultural thing. It's different. The other way is, of course, the source of the difficulty, I think, that developed was the northern objective was unification. That is, in Vietnamese pejorative terms, to take over the south. That's what they're trying to do. The NLF's objective was political power, monopoly of political power. But the difference between these two objectives is that one is divisible, in effect, and one isn't. I mean, there is really no compromise if you, if the North Vietnamese wanted to run the South, I mean, how do you compromise them? You want to get married, and the guy doesn't. Okay, you know, I say reach a compromise. Well, maybe you could in that case, right? But the point is that in theory, at least, if you want all the power and I want all the power and neither of us can get it, then we can reach an agreement to compromise, to share power. And the NLF had that possibility all the way through the war. And that's why the North Vietnamese appeared so adamant at Paris, particularly. You know, they wouldn't give an inch, and they couldn't, given their objective, which was unification. And this, of course, bothered the indigenous southerners in the NLF. The result was, to go forward on this, was that this element here was virtually destroyed in the Tet Offensive of 1970. It never amounted to anything afterwards. A part of the southerners, the front, believed that the northerners did that deliberately. These guys sat on their hands all through the Tet Offensive. The burden of the battle was on their shoulders. That made sense in some ways doctrinally, but in Viet Cong or NLF, but that was not a deliberate effort by the northerners. And we have had a number of books on this subject written by former Viet Cong, including fairly high up people. I don't know if you can, when we get to the Tet Offensive, I'll give you the details of how this went down. I mean, you can see how Southern Viet Cong could come to this conclusion. I personally don't believe it, but I'm not adamant about it. Anything else about the mechanism, the organization? Most of it too. Any of the rest of this is not clear to you. NLF is Southern. National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. National Liberation Front. The National Liberation Front. They're just called the NLF. Cong is a contraction of Vietnam Cong San, which means Vietnamese Communist. So it is inaccurate technically. The NLF was not Vietnamese Viet Cong, if you want to. Even worse, though, is in writing on this, in reading, particularly in the press, there is a tendency either to use the Viet Cong to apply to the NLF, or to use it to apply to the PLAF, or to use it to apply to the whole Khmer, everybody in the South, or in some cases even to apply only to Khazra. And I have, you know, when I read particularly contemporary accounts, I never know when the writer says the Viet Cong did so-and-so, who he's talking about. And sometimes they will say that the military arm of the Viet Cong, or the political arm of the Viet Cong, or the NLF is the military arm of the Viet Cong, or the NLF is the political arm of the Viet Cong, or the Viet Cong is the political arm of the NLF. And a passing joke. Spinoza said, the way you define a problem, the first thing, or to understand a problem, is the first thing you have to define it carefully, clearly. What is it you're talking about? all through the Vietnam War, we could never agree on the definition of the Viet Cong. I would sit at briefings and so on, and one guy would get up and talk about the Viet Cong, and I could tell from the context, but he meant the MLF. Somebody else would get up, and he would talk about the Viet Cong, and he was talking strictly about the military. And it's out to them, and they just look at you puzzled, or, you know, he's one of those intellectuals who too precise on things. But the point is that unless you have it clearly in mind who it is that you're talking about, you define clearly what it is that you're up against, you from the very beginning. And I think this is the ambiguity that developed in particularly in at the higher levels in Washington, an inability to have a common agreement as to the nature of what you were up against. Would be when you run in this word infrastructure. They talk about the Viet Cong infrastructure. The Viet Cong infrastructure is doing this. They're doing that. And you say, what is this? Is this the NLF is doing this, or who is it? Well, it's the infrastructure. You say, you know, there isn't a word in Vietnamese. They don't use the word infrastructure. If you ask them to produce an organization chart, General Giap, he would not once use them a place for infrastructure. He wouldn't describe it at all. I used to do that as a kind of, pretend that you're General Giap now. Just draw a wiring diagram, as they call it, an organization chart. He must have something like this on his wall in Hanoi, an organization chart. And just give me a terribly embarrassing thing to ask a guy. But you knew he didn't know it. I mean, I don't care how good he was. So these people didn't do any effort, make any effort to develop this. And other armies, other wars, Montgomery had an organization chart of Rommel's forces in the desert. Rommel had on his tent wall, Rommel had an organization chart of Montgomery's forces. And they had whole intelligence forces that did nothing but try to determine any kind of changes in this. We never made this effort in Vietnam. What's known as Huxley calls invincible ignorance. Ignorance is something you don't know. You know that you don't know it, but you don't think it makes any difference. Well, it may not, you know. There's a lot of things I don't know, for example. I don't know about the greenhouse effect. I don't know about melting of the polar ice cap. My office is down there on the bay, about 20 feet above sea level. If the polar ice cap melts, and if the oceans go up 40 feet, and I'm going down for the third time, I will say, well, there's an example of invincible ignorance. It's something I didn't know. I knew I didn't know it, but I said, so what? It doesn't make any difference. Now, if the polar ice cap doesn't melt, then it won't make any difference. In the case of the Vietnam War, we did not make the effort to understand this organization structure against us. We didn't think it made any difference, and in the end it did, because we wound up fighting the war on their terms and during their organizational structure. And that's when, by then, of course, the I was cast too much, and it didn't make any difference at that point whether you understood what the nature of the enemy or not. This lack of understanding, lack of attention, indifference to the organizational structure is only a tip of the iceberg. What we really didn't understand was the strategy that they used against it, and the whole concept of what they were trying to do and how they were trying to do it. Didn't know it, knew we didn't know it, didn't think it made any difference. War was going to be played on our rules. We would set the stage. This was our game, our ball game, and we set the rules, and it'd be played by those rules. Fine, if you can get away with it. It turned out that we wound up playing the war under their rules. And that's why it turned out.
You now use VPA, Vietnam People's Army. English, it isn't. The same problem with this is that the Front for Liberation and National of South Vietnam comes from French influence in Algeria, and some of which I think is the French. But there used to be a considerable argument. Is this the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam? Is this for the liberation of Vietnam, which is national?
Which, what does national apply to? Liberation or front? And everybody except me kept saying, who cares? We call them Viet Cong anyway, so that finesses the problem. The central office of South Vietnam, I mean, how bland and innocuous a title can you get? A great deal of argument as to what constituted. Military historians think of this as a movement. And neither of these is exactly right, but I'm close to it. I did have a high command in Hanoi. The orders for to, and there's really no equivalent of a high command, and Congress certainly wasn't at this. The reason for that is the nature of guerrilla war. Now, if you're fighting with divisions or big units, then you have to have a tight central control, and you have to be all the way to the top. And in fact, the Americans carried this to the Ni Flu Ultra. Remember one major telling me at one point, he was in the hills up near Khe San, and you know, they said, the president wants to talk to you. And there was Lyndon Johnson on the telephone talking to this major sitting out here on the hill. The thing had been, you know, centered, wired through the system, but Johnson liked to do that. He liked to keep the president in the guerrilla war. I mean, the NLF and the PLF did not do that. They could not do that, even if they had the communication equipment to do it, because the basic principle of all guerrilla war has to be a very tight planning in a general way, very extensive decentralization in run a guerrilla war. And you've got 150 guerrilla bands out there in the jungle. The way you can run a military where you phone and call, even if you call it, I mean, even if you could get through to them, you can't do it. Because what you have to do is give the guerrilla chief, the say he's equivalent of a captain, general instructions as to what you're to do in this area in the next 3 months, and then leave it to him to do it. There's no way you can second guess him, there's no way you can direct him day to day, it is physically impossible. Every canal is an entity all to itself. It's a one-of-a-kind thing. And so guerrilla war simply must be extremely decentralized for administrative reasons, if nothing else. Also, of course, for security reasons, because in guerrilla war is that you can be betrayed. And if one of your, if it's a hierarchy in a chain of command and you can capture a headquarters at that point, then everything else below it falls, unless these people are independent and self-contained.
Pavin and, to a very large degree, where it was a Leninist military organization,
a proletarian military organization. And that's not just an ideological double talk. It is very real, practical,
for many generations.
Necessary and economic determination, it sounds like, and it is to some extent.
Ultimate and proletarian. No, in putting
you, they wouldn't allow you to join. Later in the war, when they got very hard up, there was some tempering of this. Yes, we'll let you join, but you don't get.
All of the Ban Co can become officers. Nobody knows. That is because these are the people you think you can. Because there is a genuine adherence to this concept of class. Of class struggle
and class divisions, and that it is proper that the exploited class be the ones that carry the gun. In some cases,
people up the line,
does, of course, it harnesses and mobilizes the sense of the vast mass of people, particularly the kids from the villages. This is the way that you can get, you can go up through the ranks. This is an opportunity. It's a career thing. We're saying to you, you know, the poverty-stricken of the earth, you're the ones that we're going to allow to climb up to career success. Arvin, until very late in the war, did almost the opposite. You could not become an Arvin officer unless you had a French baccalaureate, second baccalaureate, which meant you had to go to a French-type high school, which meant that you came out of a certain class, but automatically. If you were born and raised in a small village in the Mekong Delta, your whole educational career never put you into that high school. There's really no way you could get into it, and since you didn't ever get into it, you could never become an officer. Now, the Americans pushed hard early. I mean, we're egalitarian. We don't believe in that kind of... I mean, we're with the communists here. We believe in equality. Not so much in the exploited, but in the notion that you do not have these rigid lines, such as existed to a certain degree in South Vietnam. I don't mean to exaggerate, but it was not that this was class consciousness so much in the case of the GVN. It was simply the system of education. Working backwards, the rule is you have to have a high school diploma to go to officer training candidate school. And the only way, the only people who got that were people who were in a certain urban society, a certain economic category. And the 85% or so of the people in that country who lived in villages, urban or rural, the kids from these villages never got a chance to go into the army. They did not get a chance to become officers. The NLF, of course, in their recruiting made a great deal of that. And to a large extent, I think the recruitment into the PLAF in the early years, to a very large degree, that was the sense of it. It was not grievance. It was not imperialism. It was not neocolonialism. It was not the presence of the Americans. It was not the horrors of Saigon, but it was simply, if you were a young villager, this was a way up and out. You didn't particularly like the village anyway. I mean, most of them had, as any young person has, a sense of wanderlust, the desire to, you know, to break loose and to go out into the world. And the NLF gave them an opportunity to do that. Robert Thompson, in one of his books, Sir Robert Thompson, it's in this here, this bibliography, makes a very great deal about this this business of subversion and conversion. And he goes after the notion that you subvert a young villager to the cause. You know, you persuade him to join this cause and how he becomes part of it. And he says it's actually just the opposite. You recruit first, and then you convert. Conversion almost never comes. I mean, nobody joins the army because they are against imperialism and are against the NLF abstractions. And to a village kid, particularly, that means nothing. You may join for a specific grievance. The local province chief or the district chief is corrupt, or the army comes in and destroys your house and kills all your family or steals chickens or whatever. That's a grievance. That's a motive that may push you into it. But for the most part, in the recruiting, the agitprop and the recruiting cadres of the NLF didn't want people with strong senses of grievance. It was too undependable. They didn't know, you know, what you could expect from somebody who is quite hot mad about something. They prefer somebody who does not have a grievance. And, you know, one cadre said, if we need a grievance, we manufacture one. That's why they kept away from the Buddhist demonstrations. I was quite surprised in 1963 when the Buddhists began demonstrating and self-immolation and so on against the Zim government. And the fear by the Americans was that the NLF would move in on this and try to take it over and exploit it. They didn't. They kept their hands off it all through the summer of 63. And then later, when we got a large number of defectors of these really deep South Southerners for whom the name of the game was to get Zim. You know, the objective here is to get Ngo Dinh Zim. When Ngo Dinh Zim was gotten, that was the revolution as far as they were concerned. And there was a mass return of the NLF. Early NLF was made up of numerically these other 21 organizations. Something called the Cao Dai, another called the Hoa Hao. The one private army is under the French.
Zim challenged them in 1956 in the sect wars, the so-called sect wars. And you know, there was another one called the only the French did it. And crime was both run by the French in Vietnam. These people were the major criminals of Vietnam. They were the major law enforcement element.
Well, like the mafia running Chicago in the 30s. It's a certain advantage to Vietnam.
Anyway, these organizations, numerically, these two particularly, well, these they didn't count, will be 50% of the strength of the NLF.
When Zim was overthrown. And so, for that, the rhetoric here had always been revolution. You don't say we want political power, monopolized political power. You say we want revolution in order to achieve these political objectives. But revolution was the golden word. So to these people, what revolution equated was get Zim. And when they got Zim, the revolution was over. And there was a mass exodus from these people. Was that the NLF in its structure changed its nature almost to entirely, 180 degrees. Now they had anticipated this, the front people, Coslin, had anticipated this a year earlier when there was an attempt on Zim's life. Two planes came down Noradam, the Vietnam Air Force bombed the palace and almost got Zim as a sort of an abortive coup. And I think that forced the Coslin and the people in Hanoi who were doing the overall planning to face up to the fact that Zim was mortal and he's a great utility to us in terms of mobilizing and motivating people, but he is mortal, and if anything happens to him, then we haven't got anybody there to hate that we can focus on. The successor, whoever it is, will continue this on, but it won't have the same utility. And if Zim goes, we're not sure that we can trust all of these people in the upper reaches of this. You're right at home. Yeah, over here. So you've gotten a lot of people up here at the top from the Wa Hao and the Cao Dai, and they are pretty thin reeds dedicated to getting Zim. That's the name of the game, the revolution. But the real name of the game, for the Northerners, was unification. So they began weeding these people out of these key positions. Did was overthrown, the whole system shuddered, but it managed to survive. And then we also, on the other side, got a large number of defectors and some very impressive Vietnamese. The most impressive Vietnamese I've ever known, really, were some of the ones that came in from they've been fighting the French, and then really professional guerrillas. But highly motivated, highly qualified individuals, and also all deep south southerners, very little time for the northerners. Yes, people in them, right. I wrote a book on it, 1963, so. I'm clean, there's
no, I was just wondering.
No, what happened was that they didn't ever, how can you get somebody to study and learn something that they understand what you're talking about? I want you to understand about the polar ice cap melting and we'll all be drowned. And you say to yourself, it's not going to happen. I don't have to know about the polar ice cap. And how can I force you to do this? Hey, this is not a good example, but you don't know something, you realize you don't know it, but you say, so what? There's a lot of things I don't know, so, this is a... I don't know. Looking back on it, it's very puzzling because we did not suffer from this in other wars. In other wars, in comparable situations, we made a great deal of effort to try to understand the nature of the enemy, what they thought, what they wanted, what they were doing. In London during World War II, they had a team of allied, what do you call them, who do horoscopes, astrologers, who every morning would cast Hitler's horoscope. And they didn't take this seriously, but they knew that Hitler did. So they were saying, what does Hitler's horoscope say today, and what is his astrologer telling him? And every day they did this. I mean, that's the ultimate extent of how careful you are in trying to get inside the skull of the guy on the other side. In the case of Vietnam, we never did this at all. I'm a little puzzled as to why we never did it. I'm not talking about sort of the rank and file level. I think people who were in Vietnam and were caught up in the complexities of the war understood this, and they understood that you had to understand who are these people, these guys out here. What is it that makes them tick? If you're out there, been out there fighting them for a year, this is the first thing that you think of in the morning, and you think of it all day. It's more of a case of back in Washington, where I think the thinking was that what their opinion is, or how they want to pursue the war, isn't that important, because we will determine, we here in Washington or at the top, how the war is going to be fought. It's going to be fought with airstrikes. It's going to be fought with fairly complicated military, and that's the way the game is going to be played. And so it doesn't matter too much what the other side thinks. That's the best explanation. We did not have the institutions, you know. We didn't have the offices. We didn't have the people assigned to this. At one point, we had 450,000 Americans in Vietnam, and we had one sociologist who was out doing village studies. One. Just half a dozen Vietnamese sociologists. They were all in Paris. They didn't like to work in Vietnam. I can't really blame them, but... So it isn't just the Americans, you understand. South Vietnamese get blamed for this, too. They didn't feel that they had to know much about the others. That they wrote about them, top secret analysis, but just full of rhetoric, a bunch of baby-killing, raping sons of bitches. That's what they are. You know, 40 pages. This is supposed to be a careful analysis of the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam. Written by an ex-Jesuit priest. That's why I killed my father, but he didn't know much about it. He was Zim's top advisor on the Viet Cong. I have to talk to him and said, I know what they're like. I'm a Vietnamese. That was one. I can't hear you. Associated? Disassociated from what? I don't follow the question. Oh, yes, right. Well, I don't want to get into, I want to keep you in suspense as to what happened in the Tiger Conference. But basically what happened was these guerrilla units here, who were very effective out in the jungle, were sent into the cities on missions. And they were more or less suicide missions. They were not sizable military operations. 29 went over the wall in the American embassy. Two tried to capture, were given order, two 14-year-olds to capture the palace, which had 650 caliber machine guns on the top. I mean, they didn't even get across the street before they were cut down. The three of them. I got the story from the third one who turned around and went out the back door. They were not serious military assaults, but they were by people who were used to fighting in the jungle, but did not know how to fight in the cities, and who ought not to have fought in the city. And that's broke the basic principles of guerrilla war. You can imagine Lao Tse-tung or saying, like the general who stood at the heights at the charge of the Light Brigade, as the British rode into the cannon, and there was a slaughter, and it's magnificent, but it's not war. And you can almost imagine when Liu Shaoqi saw 70,000 of the cream of the PLAF just gutted in the streets of Saigon and other 32 cities. It's magnificent, but it's not people's war. The question is, why did they do it? And the answer was, as General Jop said, this is the last hurrah. This is the big one. This is where we're going to win. It's going to be all over when this, when the dust settles. There'll be a general uprising, and well, I can't get off into the strategy that was involved, but essentially that's what happened. I believe, South Vietnamese believe, not only, but a lot of ex-Viet Cong believe that this was done deliberately. We'll get rid of these guys once and for all, because we're going to win next week. What we don't want is some military force in the South, this structure, that it will prevent unification. We'll say, the name of the game is revolution down here. The name of the game is not... I think everybody, military, I think you always are fighting the last war rather than the next war. And I think every army in the world tends to do this. I don't know exactly what the answer is, but if you go through a very traumatic experience and you learn something, you know, it's like in fighting a war. I mean, you learn things, you see things happen. And then peace comes, and now you're in charge of preparing the defenses. Your mindset, your model, has to be the last war. You don't have anything else to think with. And so mostly what you say, well, what did we do wrong back there? That's what we've got to not do. We say, no, lessons of Vietnam. We must not make them, must learn from Vietnam and not make the mistakes in Vietnam, in Nicaragua, or wherever. Very dangerous thinking, but I don't know how a civilian planner can you need bottles of thought.